Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Some of the world's oldest living organisms are in the immediate path of danger. The Washburn Fire burning within Yosemite National Park is threatening Mariposa Grove, home to giant sequoia trees believed to be some of the largest and oldest living things on the planet. As the fire enters its fourth day, the smoke has begun to impact air quality from the Tahoe Basin to the Bay Area. And the activity was reportedly so intense, it catapulted tree debris hundreds of feet into the air, nearly striking a firefighting aircraft. So, how is that possible? Part of the answer, according to Dr. Craig Clements, professor of meteorology and climate science at San Jose State, has to do with the weather inside and surrounding the fire. Craig leads the university's Fire Weather Research Laboratory, which is the only one of its kind in the country, and joins us about their ongoing research into extreme fire behavior and new research programs in Northern California launching this fire season. Professor Clements, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Starting off, when did the Fire Weather Research Lab at San Jose State begin, and what type of data do you gather?
Oh, well, we started in 2007 and kind of got bigger and bigger. And in 2020, we actually hired five tenure track faculty and started the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center. The types of data that we collect are kind of unique in terms of meteorology and wildfire science. We actually go out to active wildfires with Doppler radar, Doppler LiDAR, which is like a radar but uses a laser beam. And we can collect winds, plume structures. We can look and peer inside these plumes, which is very important to understand the dynamics of how the fire is behaving and what the atmosphere is doing to drive that fire.
I mean, the timing of scaling up this weather research lab comes, you know, when California has experienced, you know, record wildfires, and you have over two decades of meteorological field observations. How does the approach to studying wildfires differ from other weather events in your field?
Well, it's difficult to study wildfire, actually, unlike other severe weather phenomena like thunderstorms and tornadoes and hurricanes, because we just don't have dedicated assets to study wildfire. And that's changing, which is great. So we basically take a storm chasing approach where we see a fire that's of interest scientifically, and we go out to it, and everybody's fire line qualified. Our team can be actually ordered as a national resource, so we can get called to a fire by incident command teams. We could collect the data as close as we can. And so we get some really exciting observations, which are used to not only understand the fire behavior, but also to better tune our prediction models, because these models don't have a lot of the data that are needed to make sure that they're on the right track.
Well, given that, what are some of the most notable fire weather events that you've observed in recent years?
Well, I guess probably some of these rotating columns or fire-generated tornadoes. That's something that's of everybody's interest, of course. Another few things are fire-induced winds and strong updrafts, as you mentioned earlier, of this tree branch being lofted by the plume. These are things that we don't have good observations of. And in 2016, we actually had the opportunity to fly an aircraft through a pyrocumulonimbus in Idaho on the Pioneer Fire, and we were able to measure updraft velocity. So these are strong winds that go vertically from the fire, as strong as 120 miles per hour. And so those are the type of winds that we can see, which can clearly loft branches and parts of trees and such. So it's not surprising that that was seen on the Washburn Fire the other day.
I mean, just visualizing what you're laying out, I can only imagine the durability of the equipment that you use, not to mention the risk that you all take when you head out there. I mean, you've called yourself like a storm chaser.
Yeah, I mean, there's not too much risk. I mean, we're very careful. We're tied in with the incident command team. And so we basically stay close to the road, and we don't, you know, as long as we can get good observations. And the thing about what we're doing is we're launching weather balloons, and we're using radar and things that we can scan from a safe distance. And so it's exciting at times. Fire can get pretty close, but it's never a dire situation. But some of the aircraft observations are quite unique, and that's going farther this year. We're going to be flying our own imaging system on a NOAA aircraft over some wildfires in California. So that's going to be some new information and new data and testing some new camera systems.
Yeah, that is exciting. Let's get into the two fires in our region over the past week. The Electra fire, which began a week ago in Amador and Calaveras counties, is now 85% contained. But the Washburn fire in and around Yosemite has burned some 2,000 acres. I believe it's 0% containment as of this morning. Are these wildfires consistent with what we should be experiencing this early in the summer?
Yeah, I mean, we're in July. This is pretty typical. Again, these fires haven't grown dramatically over the course of the last few days, right? It's, you know, the Electra fire keeps topping out at about 4,000 acres. The Washburn fire now is, you know, it's obviously a total concern, and some of these reports of these updrafts is concerning. But generally, if you look at some of the smoke plumes and some of the structures, it's, you know, it's burning low intensity, but that could change because we are getting into a little bit drier conditions today and tomorrow, and it's going to be warmer. So as the temperature goes up, the fuel's dry, and that allows those fires to burn more intensely. So it could be problematic the next couple of days, but I would imagine they're going to get a good jump on it.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. In California, when it comes to acres burned so far this year, according to CAL FIRE, we're below last year and even the five-year average. But across the United States, it's kind of a 180. The National Interagency Fire Center reports the year-to-date acres burned is 220% above the 10-year average. So let's take a wider lens. Explain what's happening.
Well, the whole western U.S. is under a drought, so there's fires in other parts of the country. Those can burn a little bit more intensely. So like looking at New Mexico and some of the fires that we had there earlier this summer, you know, those are big acreage burns. And so that's adding to what we're seeing in the national amount of acres burned. So California, we're a little bit below right now, but, you know, we're just ramping into our core fire season. I consider August and September. And so, we've been kind of lucky, and part of that is because of the weather. It's been a little cooler in Northern California, and we had some late rain in the Sierra in June, and so that really helps dampen the fire danger, fire risk. And the next couple of days, actually, over Northern California, there's only a few areas that are above moderate fire risk or, like, very high. So we're still pretty lucky so far this month.
Yeah, I mean, there's been kind of a weather whiplash in the last month or so, at least where we are here in Sacramento, because June was one of the hottest Junes on record for the Sacramento Valley. I mean, we had 11 days of 100-plus degree weather, 8 days in the 90s. But then the region also experienced that kind of, like, 180 cooler than normal temperatures just earlier this month. How does that impact firefighting, given the Electra fire ignited on July 4th and is now 85% contained?
Well, the cooler the temperatures, the better it is, because you get better recovery of humidity. So the humidity can go up at night. And so the fires can, like, kind of dampen down at night typically. But we've been seeing over the last few years that nighttime fire behavior during the nighttime hours is increased. And so when we get these cooler, we get a cold front that moves through the region, brings colder air, and that can actually dampen fire behavior, particularly because it's just cooler and the fuel moisture, the moisture content in the plants actually isn't as low as it would be if it was really, really hot. Like when we had the heat wave in 2020 and we had the lightning outbreak, we had lots of large fires real quickly. And so this year, I think we've been pretty lucky.
Given that we're in our third year of drought-like conditions, how does that further compound the circumstances that we're dealing with and the conditions that we're in?
Well, the drought really affects our fires because what happens is those fuels are stressed, so plants, the shrubs, and they are more easily ignitable the drier they are. So if they're stressed because of drought over multiple years, we have a lot of mortality in the plants. So we have more dead plants, and so the dead plants or dead fuels will burn easier than the live plants. And even our live fuel moisture is something that we sample regularly in the Bay Area, and we look about that live fuel moisture. So how that works is teams go out into the field, but they clip shrubs of different species, and they take it back to the lab, and then we look at how much water content's in those plants. And we monitor this every 2 weeks. And so right now we're just about below average. We're not at our minimum, so that's good. but we're between average and below average. So we're a little drier than we should be. And that's kind of remarkable, being that we're in this drought. I figured it was going to be a little bit worse. So, yeah, so that's how, so as the fuel moisture, as we go through the summer and we get into our fall, the live fuel moisture of those plants will be at the minimum. And that's the same time we have our minimum in fuel moisture content is when we have our most frequent period of Santa Ana winds and Northern California north winds and Diablo winds. So when we get those big wind events, that's when our fuel moistures are the lowest. That's why we have a lot of big fires in September and October.
Right. You know, your research center is doing research that previously hasn't been done. And really the goal is to promote sharing of information and the data that you're collecting from the University at San Jose State to industry. How does your research help both state and federal firefighting combat wildfires?
Well, yeah, we have a unique center set up. We're a National Science Foundation, industry, university cooperative research center. So we have industry partners, the utilities, insurance companies, federal agencies, and some startups that actually are partnering in the center, and they help drive the research so it helps their industry. One of the things that we're doing is we're building, we have a state of the science model that is operational, and this model is what we call a coupled fire atmosphere model, and it allows us to look at how fires create their own weather. If we don't couple fire models with the atmospheric model, like a weather model, then we can't really predict how they're going to create big plumes, you know, big clouds, and the extreme fire behavior on the ground. And so this modeling system, which is state of the science, is operational, meaning we are running it as a weather model operationally when a fire breaks out. And last summer, we ran it for Dixie Fire, we ran it for the Caldor Fire, and we were getting requests from Forest Service, Cal Fire, to run certain fires. And so we're ramping that up right now, and we're getting more computing resources. And just a shout out to Assemblymember Osh Carla for securing funding for the center. So we're going to be able to quadruple our computing power this next year and be able to do more simulations. And that'll be for the state of California. So we're really excited about that.
Well, given that the Dixie and the Caldor fires were the first wildfires known in state history to crest over the Sierra, and the Dixie fire approached like 1 million acres, what did you learn from both of those wildfires last year?
Well, it was kind of interesting. We're still doing the analysis from some of the simulations and some of the data that we collected, but you know, the drier the fuels at those higher elevations because of the lower snowpack from the drought, that causes higher elevation fuel moistures to be lower. So the fire was able to spread to higher altitudes in the Sierra. So that's something that was, you know, a lot of people talked about that and noticed that. We also observed the fire burning up and over the Sierra crest with our radar and saw some rotating vortices or circulations within the fire plume that burned down to Highway 395. So that's something that I'm working on with a colleague at the University of Nevada, Reno, analyzing. And so there's some really exciting dynamics that occurred because those fires burned so intensely last year.
Yeah. How has our understanding of the dynamics of how wildfires create their own weather and the role that it has on fire behavior, how has that changed since you and your team began your research?
Well, Al, yeah. So, more people are analyzing Pyrocumulo Nimbus, so these big fire clouds, the thunderstorms that are driven off the wildfires. The modeling community, so the prediction systems are getting better. They're taking into account these types of interactions between the fire and the atmosphere. And the data that we've been collecting has actually proven to be very useful. And so it's becoming more regular for us to get out and use radar. So people were not using radar on wildfires as much as they should have been. And now it's quite common in the community. So we're actually using more meteorological tools to study fire behavior. And we're actually using getting more measurements on wildfires. So launching weather balloons on wildfires. The National Incident Meteorologist Program adopted radio SONs, which are weather balloons, okay? And they launch those at wildfires to get the atmospheric conditions around the incident. And so that's kind of new. And all these observations are getting better and better, and it's allowing us to learn more about the fire environment. Mm.
Finally, Professor Clements, you know, we're in another wildfire season in 2 years. How should we be viewing the coming months ahead?
Well, I would think that Californians should be expecting a higher than normal fire activity, which, you know, obviously if you compare the last 2 years, what's normal? But we should expect smoky skies throughout the summer once we get if we get a big fire going. And there's a chance that we could have a number of large fires burning around the state. And again, it's up to having ignitions. If we don't have ignitions, we won't have the fire. So everybody has to be careful if they're out in the forests and playing, because it's, you know, 9 out of 10 fires are human caused. So
literally 9 out of 10. I think it's 90% exactly.
Yeah.
Craig Clements is a professor of meteorology and climate science, director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Up next, we will have a discussion with three women changing the mindset that fire is the enemy, now leading and fostering a long overdue relationship with prescribed burns. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. As wildfire season ramps up in California, there's a growing push to change the decades-long mindset of fire suppression, which has led to dense areas of vegetation that, coupled with climate change and drought, has contributed to extreme fire risk across the state. The conversation and funding is shifting to change the way we live with fire, which includes reintroducing a long-overdue relationship with prescribed burns to manage forests and reduce mega-record wildfires in recent years. Joining us now are leading experts in forestry management from the Bay Area to the North Coast and Central Sierra, and all women in a field that historically has been overwhelmingly male and white. Dr. Sasha Berlman is the director of Fire Forward Program at the nonprofit Audubon Canyon Ranch, based in the Bay Area, and is the first graduate of the state's Burn Boss Program. Lenya Quinn Davidson is a fire advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension in Humboldt County. And Susie Coker is a forestry advisor, also with the University of California Cooperative Extension, based in South Lake Tahoe. Welcome all to Insight, and good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
I'm curious, with the three of you, what drew each of you to fire science, forest management, even firefighting? And when you began, what did diversity look like or not look like? And Sasha, I want to start with you. You've been a wildland firefighter with a hotshot crew based in Redding. So let's start with you.
Yeah, I was really drawn to this quite a while back. I grew up in Southern California in a town surrounded by wildfires every summer. So it was something that I had a lot of experience with and a lot of fear of as a kid, wildfire in particular. And I didn't even know about the fact that people had been living in this really positive way with fire for millennia until I reached community college. Like, it took that long for me to even know that that was the foundation of this place that we live in. And so when I finally learned that, it felt like, in this world full of so many problems that, like, we just can't seem to solve, that is something that we should be able to come to a solution for.
Yeah, and given you're a state certified burn boss, which is a new program, explain what your role is.
Yeah, so in the program that I'm leading, we're primarily training and teaching people about building this relationship with fire, so that we can basically bring good fire to the hands of the people. And part of that is implementation of good fire on the ground and allowing people to participate in that with the proper training. And so I pursued that certificate so that I could help lead Burns and then teach others to lead Burns in this area.
What did diversity look like when you first began your career? And has that changed over recent years as the conversation continues to evolve?
I think we're all constantly trying to continue building diversity in this field. I would say that people like Lenya and others were already doing that work well before I joined or really like got my feet under me, making a difference here. So I don't think I've seen tremendous change in the time that I've been doing it, but I walked into this already seeing change happening, and we're all working to continue pushing that change forward.
Yeah. Well, Susie, that brings me to you. Your background in forestry goes back almost two decades.
Three, actually, if you're counting.
Oh, three decades, yes.
If you're not, that's okay, too.
Not the best at arithmetic. Thank you.
All right. Well, I was very interested in doing something in the outdoors. My family was not at all outdoorsy, and I got all my exposure to camping and canoeing and all those things through Girl Scouting, actually. And I had some great Girl Scout mentors, and one was a forester. I was thinking about what to study, and I was afraid of getting a job where I had to wear pantyhose and pointy shoes. And actually, this has turned out great for me. I really enjoy being able to have that outdoor component in my professional life.
You know, given that you've been involved in forestry now for nearly three decades and you're based in the Sierra and South Lake Tahoe, how has your role and how you view wildfires and the relationship with fire changed over that time?
It's changed a lot. When I first started there, you know, there would be big fires. I remember the Cottonwood Fire in Sierra County was 100,000 acres in about 1993. And that was just amazing. Nobody could believe it. And now we're getting million acre fires. So clearly there's been a huge uptake in that. There's been a big stress on forest health. We had a huge drought and 180 million dead trees, a lot of those concentrated in Sierra Nevada. So the needs have just gotten more urgent for doing fuels reduction and reducing the density of forests over time. Mm. The need's always been there, but the urgency is just amped up every year.
Yeah. Lenya, you've joined us before on Insight, and you're based in the North Coast, and you really focus on the human connection with fire. Where did that begin for you?
You know, my story is kind of similar to Sasha. I grew up in a really remote part of Northern California in Trinity County, and just, you know, surrounded by fire every year. My mom used to work as a cook on big wildfires. So it was a real, it was just a big part of my childhood. And when I went to college, I started taking classes and learning that this was really a natural process and really important. And that was a shift in the way that I had to think about fire. You know, a lot of people who grow up in communities that are impacted by fire are scared of it, understandably. So yeah, it definitely came from my home place.
Yeah. Well, remind us how fire is an essential part of California's ecosystem.
Well, you know, most California ecosystems are either fire adapted, meaning that they have evolved, you know, to withstand fire, or they're actually fire dependent, meaning that they actually require fire in some way to persist on the landscape. So when we look around anywhere you are in California, that landscape's going to have a fire story to tell. And it's up to us to figure out what that is. It looks different in different places. Sometimes it's really frequent fire. You know, sometimes these habitats need fire to regenerate, like the giant sequoia. So yeah, there's such a strong connection between the trees and the plants that we all love and fire in California. It's really an important process here.
What have been the consequences of muting that relationship over the last decades in terms of what the landscape of forests and vegetation look like?
There have been huge ecological and cultural consequences from keeping fire off the landscape. So we, of course, see, like Susie mentioned, forest densification. So a lot more trees and a lot more shrubs on the landscape. And those are sucking water out of the ground. They're less healthy because they're so thick and they're competing with each other. They're more vulnerable to drought mortality, like Craig was talking about in the previous segment. So we see a lot of that overly dense vegetation, but also species composition shifts, you know, so we're seeing that we're losing certain species that really rely on fire, and then other species that don't have as strong a connection with fire are taking over. So you can think of it kind of like invasive species. A lot of other kinds of species are favored when there isn't fire on the ground.
You know, Susie, since you can really have the hindsight of going back like three decades, when it comes to the tradition of controlled burns, I mean, was there a period in the beginning where it just didn't happen at all? And that's really been scaling up in years since?
Well, I would say different public agencies have been burning for some amount of time, and it's different by agency. The Park Service has been doing a lot of burning for at least 30 or 40 years. The Forest Service is trying to scale up and does some amount. What's really changing now is the amount of fire being used on private lands, partially because of these amazing ladies here with me trying to help private landowners learn how to burn and take care of their own properties.
Yeah, well, Sasha, you're a burn boss. How has the conversation and investment changed in regards to wildfire management as opposed to primarily suppression and prevention?
You're asking about using wildfires
yes.
to accomplish objectives. Yeah, in our area, I mean, I'm working in the Bay Area, and that's still mostly being seen as not even really an option to talk about. I think it's gaining more traction on federal lands, although we are starting to have conversations about PODs, which is potential operational delineation systems or something like that.
It's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. So PODs works well. And the idea is that like we would use these predetermined roads or ridges to contain fire, which I think makes a lot of sense with the fires that we've been seeing lately. And once we get those underway, there's also the potential that those could be used as, you know, big box prescribed burns to working on a landscape scale. So there's some hope there.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about prescribed fire with three leaders in their respective fields, Dr. Sasha Berlman, Lenya Quinn-Davidson, and Susie Coker. I'm curious, since, you know, we really have a pretty wide canvas from the Bay Area to the North Coast to the Central Sierra, there has been a record investment from the state when it comes to prescribed firing operations. But I'm curious, and Sasha, you touched upon this in the Bay Area, when working with residents and the community, how has a community mindset changed when it comes to a relationship with fire? Lenya, I'll start with you.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think that there has been a major shift in the conversation around prescribed fire in California over the last, you know, in my career. I've been working on this for 15 years, and I'd say in the last 5 years, there's just been a radical change in the way people are talking about it. And I think we've moved from the conversation being how can we get the public on board with prescribed fire to how can we meet the demands of the public around prescribed fire. People want it. They know it's important, and they're asking for it. And so people like Susie and Sasha and I are just trying to keep up with the demand. There's such an appetite for this work, and it's because it's so positive. Like Sasha said, it's a solution oriented, you know, something people can sink their teeth into and can feel good about, and people want to be involved. So we really can just barely keep up. Yeah. We can't keep up, actually. And our phones are ringing off the hook, and people want to take part in this.
Yeah, Susie, I mean, we're talking about multiple arms in this, from public to private. How do you, I guess, collaborate and organize private landowners and volunteers to manage and control fires?
Well, mostly I'm helping organize private landowners to help do controlled fires themselves. But over the last few years, I've been working with people like Lenya and Sasha to host educational workshops. Over the last 4 years, we've had about 33 workshop days throughout the Sierra Nevada, and we've had 1,000 people attend. And since one of the locations where we do a lot of burning, UC Berkeley's Research Forest at Blodgett in Georgetown, is very close to the Capitol. We've had a lot of people from state government, state agencies, big nonprofits. There really has not been any other location to learn about how to do prescribed fire mm-hmm. before we started doing this. If you're an individual, you can't really go to a agency burning class. You can't partake with agencies in burning. And so really these events need to be structured around landowners' needs in locations where they can take part. So usually we do a one-day workshop where we learn all about fire and firing methods and goals and control. And then we do it in the field burn, usually. Sometimes we've been rained out or not gotten a permit, but we've gotten about half those people to be able to hold a drip torch and start to burn stuff. And it's super fun. People are so excited, like Lenya said. Some people are concerned when they see fire on the ground, but generally it's about 15 minutes of watching it burn slowly until they're kind of bored and they realize this is not going to burn my house down if we do everything right. Yeah. This is actually a tool that I could possibly use at my house.
You, given that, I mean, you're talking about over 1,000 people expressing interest. I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, are there, when listening to these people, are there challenges when it comes to private landowners wanting to use prescribed fire on their property? And how do you overcome those barriers?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is just the experience level. We do find people who've been burning with their families for some generations, but they're rare. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about burning and how to do it. There's a lot of concern over liability, which is natural. But a lot of the people I work with are already burning piles on their property. And really, the liability is not any different than when you're burning a pile. And so it's more about people's lack of comfort and lack of experience than anything that's more dangerous, in my opinion. And so helping people overcome that, giving them technical assistance so they can learn how to put in control lines on their property and what might be a good start really helps. And we're starting small. We're starting with maybe landowners having, you know, 10 acres and burning 1 acre with their neighbors. And then they learn really that comfort level. And that may not sound big, but when you think about the fact that there are over 75,000 forest landowners in California that have at least 10 acres, if they each burned 1 acre or 3 acres, you would actually be making a dent in this problem.
Yeah, I mean, that mindset is huge. And given, you know, Susie, you're in South Lake Tahoe, Lania, you're up in Humboldt. Sasha, you're in the Bay Area. I mean, each area has its own unique, you know, dynamics. So, Sasha, what have you learned from educating community stakeholders? What are they telling you?
We've really been seeing since we launched this program, there was a lot of trauma in 2017 from the first catastrophic wildfires that hit here and ever since. And we're seeing that when people get involved in this work, it's healing trauma that they experience. It's healing their relationship with fire and with living in this place that's fire dependent, because they're realizing that fire is a part of life here and that they have an active role that they can play. They can develop a meaningful relationship with fire. It doesn't have to be trauma driven. So that's been a really big learning for me, is just how important this process is for learning how to live in California in a meaningful way. And then that has all of these trickle down repercussions around how we choose to build our homes, what they're made out of, where they're placed. So there are some additional benefits to healing people's relationship with fire and helping them understand what that relationship is and that responsibility to steward land. I think we are also seeing that this is a self-propagating effort. You know, we set the seed in there and now it's so many people are interested in, and as people meet each other in the community, more and more landowners, more and more residents and community members who don't own land just want to be a part of this movement and see change and be part of actualizing change on the ground.
Yeah. And coupled with that is record investment. I mean, the state allocated $1.5 billion for wildfire prevention and forest health last year. I'm just curious. I mean, besides devoting a significant amount of money to the situation, what else does the state need to do to address wildfire prevention? Susie?
Well, I have been participating with the Wildfire Resilience Task Force on different work groups. I know Lenya's been on the Prescribed Fire work group. I've been on the Small Landowner work group. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there's at least 75,000 landowners of 10 acres or more of forest in California. So what this, in my opinion, what the state needs to do is help those people figure out how to manage their own property, help with regulatory barriers, and outreach and education, and cost share funding. There's a big chunk of that funding that you're describing is going into helping landowners do projects which don't give any revenue back, right? So forest management is a expensive proposition. There's so many fuels out there. There's a lot of trees to thin out. And a lot of landowners just don't have the funding to do that. So helping them get through management plans and doing cost share so that they can move forward to reduce that risk on their own property is really how we're going to get there, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, Lenny, when listening to Susie, it just sounds like we're also, it's a lot of catch up too.
Yeah. Yeah. We're definitely so far behind on this work. And there's a lot, you know, there's some other things that the state can do. There was a strategic plan earlier this year that was released by the state, a strategic plan for expanding the use of beneficial fire. So if people want to dig in on this, they could, you know, Google that and look at that. And it outlines a lot of different things that we need to be doing in California to increase this work and to get more good fire on the ground. And so some of the things that I've been working on and that we're really lucky to have some leadership in the legislature on are changing the liability standard in California for prescribed fire. We did that last year, which was a huge win. And then this year we're working on setting up a state-backed kind of insurance pool for prescribed fires so that if, you know, in the rare case that there's some kind of damage from prescribed fire, that we'll have a way to cover that. So Senator Dodd from the North Bay area has been leading on that, and it's been really great to start tackling some of those policy challenges that we have for prescribed fire. Because like Susie said, landowners are very concerned about liability, and any way that we can help increase their comfort around the liability issue, you know, that really helps.
Yeah, and you're talking about Senate Bill 332. Yeah, and it was signed, you know, just last fall. And when talking about the plan, that you, the strategic plan, we actually did a segment on that, so people can listen to the Insight segment when it first was published. Sasha, ending with you, I'm just curious, because all three of you are an important component to this as well. Do all of you collaborate a lot together? It seems like y'all are familiar with each other.
Yeah, we definitely collaborate a lot. I've known Lenya since I stepped in this field. She was already like a major leader in this community, and Susie as well. I met Susie when I was in school still. So I'm really honored to be on this show today with two people who've been mentors for me and for over a decade now. Yeah, we work a lot together, and it's a really pretty tight-knit community of leaders, I'd say, too, all working together very much from the heart, trying to make a difference in this.
Well, I want to thank all of you for the work that you're doing and making the time to join us this morning.
Thanks for having us, Vicki.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Dr. Sasha Berlman is the director of the Fire Forward Program at the nonprofit Audubon Canyon Ranch based in the Bay Area and is the first graduate of the state's Burn Boss Program. Lenya Quinn Davidson is a fire advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension in Humboldt County. And Susie Coker is a forestry advisor also with the University of California Cooperative Extension based in South Lake Tahoe. Still ahead, jazz pianist, composer, and lyricist Dave Bass joins us ahead of his concert at the Auburn State Theater. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Dave Bass is a pianist, composer, and lyricist with a musical career that started at the age of 7. He played piano all throughout his childhood, college years, and then supported his family as a full-time musician. But that destiny was abruptly halted after an accident seriously damaged his wrist and sidelined his music career. But that's when Dave took a hard left turn and enrolled in law school, passing the bar and eventually becoming a California Deputy Attorney General. But his passion for music was just simply on pause. 20 years after Dave's injury, while still working at the AG's office, an impromptu event at a party reshaped and restarted his musical career all over again. We're going to talk to him about that moment in just a minute, and we'll learn more about his music, like this piece called El Cordobés. And we are delighted to have Dave Bass here in the studio to talk about his work as a pianist once again. Welcome to Insight, Dave.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so happy to have you. Well, we're going to pick up the story from where we kind of left off. When you were at that party, not having played music professionally, at least, for 2 decades, what happened in that moment?
Well, the guy who was having the party simply asked me to sit in between 2 bands' performances, and I agreed to do that. And the bass player from one of those bands, a fine local bassist, Harley White Jr., came over and said, "Oh, can I sit in with you?" And I said, "Oh, sure." And we played, and he invited me to jam sessions, and the beast was reawakened, so to speak. And it was, even though my chops, you know, my technique was really down, I had a lot of pent-up emotion that came out. So it was exhilarating to play again.
Given that it had been about 20 years since you were playing professionally, and you talk about that pent-up emotion, when it came up, did it surprise you when you were actually playing?
A little bit, yeah, it did surprise me.
I can imagine so. I mean, since then, let's talk about your musical journey since you resumed playing music professionally.
Yes. Well, for a few years, I did both. I had 1 foot in the law and 1 foot in music. And finally, it just the music was just too seductive. And I was seduced and retired from my legal career and just have been doing music full-time ever since. I have this wonderful trio that I work with now, with Kerry Kashiwagi on bass and Scott Gordon on drums. And we're going to be playing August 6th at the Auburn State Theater, which is a wonderful venue with tiered seating, great Steinway grand piano, great sound system. So we hope everyone can come up to Auburn and see the trio.
It's a short drive, about 30 minutes from Sacramento, in a beautiful area, too. Yeah,
indeed.
Well, we're going to get a little bit a taste of the range of some of your tracks. So we're going to start off with Bud on Bach. I do not need a cup of coffee when listening to that. That is just wonderful. And I'm just visualizing your fingers on the piano. You got to unpack the name for me, Bud on Bach.
Well, it's a composition by one of my piano heroes, Bud Powell, and he took he recorded that as a solo piece, and he took the CPE Bach piece, which we just heard, played that, and then went into sort of a jazzy version of the theme, which another 15 seconds we would have heard there, and that's the title. So it's his tune. I do another Bud Powell tune on this on Volume 2, A Tempest Fugit, and I love Bach. I mean, I think Bach is probably the most important musician I've ever encountered, and I spend a lot of time encountering him at home. You know, yeah. I don't consider myself a classical performer, but that piece is sort of a nice way to enter that world where Bach and jazz intersect. And Bud knew that. You know, this he recorded this probably 1951 or so, I think Bach swings like hell. I mean, I think his rhythmic propulsion is on a par with the best swinging jazz, and there you are.
And you certainly capture it in that piece. Now we're going to head to Volume 2, because you do have two volumes, and the next song we're going to play is Baltic Bolero. If I understand this correctly, this was an original composition that you wrote while on a cruise with your wife in the Baltic Sea.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And very cleverly, when she heard me play it, she said, "Well, oh, it's Baltic Bolero." And I said, "Okay." And the name stuck. And
And the rest is history.
Yeah, this is the second time I've recorded this tune. The first time was on New York City Sessions with the late, great Phil Woods. And I added a fine local guitarist, Barry Finnerty, on this one, who previously recorded with Miles. And this is sort of a fresh version of it.
Well, it's wonderful. And we have one last one before we let you go. We're going to listen to Gandinga from Volume 2. Spice in this. And you've said that Afro-Cuban music is somehow part of your musical DNA, and it really shows. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have always loved this music, and it's both dance music at the most basic level, but it's also very, very complex and deep rhythmically, and I do my best to do it. This is by a great Cuban pianist, Frank Emilio Flynn, and it's simply in 4/4, but the accents are so quirky that even a lot of seasoned musicians, when they hear it or try to play it, assume it's in some very odd time signature.
Well, if people want to take in your music, and I really don't blame them, it's just wonderful. You're going to be performing at the Auburn State Theater, as you mentioned, on Saturday, August 6th. And yep. I imagine tickets still on sale?
Tickets, there's still tickets available. You can go to my website to get them, www.davebassmusic.com.
And we also have a link on our Insight page. Thank you so much, Dave.
My pleasure, Vicki. Thank you.
And that is jazz pianist, composer, and lyricist Dave Bass, who will be performing at the Auburn State Theater. And we have more information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carell Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.